Let me add my welcome to Steve. It's great to see you here. And we're continuing our series in the book of 1 and 2 Kings, which we have called God's Superheroes, because Elijah and Elisha, I think, are the superheroes of the Bible. Apart from Jesus, they're the pair who do more miracles than anyone else and have all sorts of special powers. I feel slightly more informed today because late on Friday night, I went with Dean and Grace to see Captain Marvel at the Greenwich Picture House. I'm slightly more tuned into the superhero theme, and I think that sort of helped me get some context. But of course, this is real life rather than just Marvel fantasy. We're going to be reading from 2 Kings chapter 6, and I haven't got the page number, but it is on, let me just find it, page 312. Yeah, thank you. You got there ahead of me, some of you, but others, turn to page 312 and 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 1. We like to try and go through all sorts of books of the Bible at Grace Church, and we work through week by week, passage by passage. And we've been in 2 Kings, I think, for the last four or five, and then we're taking a pause, and next week we're looking at Easter, the next 2 weeks, at Jesus' death and resurrection. And then we'll be back in Philippians, and then later in the year back in 2 Kings. So this is the last installment of the superhero story for a while, and it's a great story. 2 Kings chapter 6. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and each of us there get a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there." And he answered, "Go." Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." He answered, "I will go." So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. "Alas, my master, it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, "Take it up." So he reached out his hand and took it. Once, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servant, saying, "At such and such a place shall be my camp." But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there." And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." And he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." It was told him, "Behold, he's in Dothan." So he sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" He said, "Don't be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elijah prayed to the Lord and said, "Please strike this people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I'll bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see." And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you've taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they'd eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Well, what a fantastic story, and what do we make of it? Well, I wonder if you noticed, even as we were reading, it's a story all about blindness and sight. And so you'll see immediately where we got the theme of the service from, and the track that Steve was on with his kids talk, and the reason we sang those songs about opened eyes. And I want to begin by asking, a bit like Steve did, but from a different angle, how well do you see? You know, I can't see much without my glasses, but I also, yeah, I can't, it's quite comforting. I can just, it's me and a Bible. But there you all are. But actually, I also can't see colours very well. And maybe you've done one of these tests before. Okay, there's a number there. And I want you to be really honest about the number that you yourself see. So if you can see a number 7, please put your hand up. If you can see a number 3, put your hand up. It's very obviously a 3, isn't it? I'm in very much agreement with those people. And the weirdos amongst you who think it's number 8, put your hand up. Yeah, there we are. So we've now outed the colorblind members of Grace Church Greenwich. If you're colorblind, that is clearly a 3. I can't even believe that you can see otherwise. And this one's even harder for the colorblind people. That just isn't any numbers at all, I don't think, but apparently it is. Who can tell me? Who with the magic power of color sight can tell us what it is? 71, apparently. I mean, if you're colorblind like me, you're thinking, what? That's just dots, right? Yeah, there you go. Thanks very much. So that is all of the visual tests for today. So Steve and I are both on working different angles of the optician. Maybe you need glasses, or maybe if you can't see colours, that's just bad luck, basically. There's no glasses that will help you, like I can't. How clearly do we think we can see? This is the first strand of this story. It's all about blindness and sight, about who can see and who realises that they can't see. How much sight do you have? And we begin with Elisha. This is why, Elijah is the predecessor, and Elisha is his successor, and that is a typo. Elisha has superhero sight, because he can see everything. So much so that whenever the king of Syria is going down with to set an ambush for the Israelites in such and such a place, Elisha just goes and sends his intelligence ahead and tells the king of Israel, don't go to there because there's an ambush for you. And he saves him on several occasions because of this. He has this sort of supernatural ability to see things a long way away. And this is a classic superhero thing, isn't it? Because I think Superman can see through walls, can't he? He can see through everything apart from lead or something like that. And you can see where the superhero Marvel franchise have got it from. They've nicked it out of the Bible. Because here's a real superhero who can really see things that happen a long way away. In fact, we saw it last week with Gehazi, the hapless Baldric kind of character, who steals a load of stuff from Naaman the Syrian and doesn't realize that his master could see everything. It's as if Elisha's equipped with this kind of spiritual CCTV. He's just got intel on everything that's going on. And he just warns the king of Israel, don't go there, that's where the ambush is. And the king of Syria is very perplexed, and he assumes, because he doesn't know about people having supernatural sight, he assumes there just must be a mole in his cabinet. So he says to them in verse 11, will you not tell me who of us is for the king of Israel? In other words, who is actually secretly working for the enemy? Because I can't understand how every time we go and set a trap, he already knows where we are before we get there. Which of you is leaking it? And the answer is none of them are. Oh no, it's because this guy called Elisha, he even hears the stuff that's going on in your own bedroom. In other words, in the super secret inner chamber. He knows. God's prophet has superhero sight and superhero hearing. Before the days of Amazon Alexa and MI5, I'm sure now know most of what goes on in our bedroom if you have one of those, because they can turn the microphones on. God has the spiritual version. And even that's a sobering thought, isn't it? That God knows everything that we do and everything that we say. doesn't need somebody to report on us. Doesn't need a special bug in the room. He has supernatural sight, and he gives it to Elisha, his prophet, who has superhero sight. As you think about God, I wonder if you think of him as the all-seeing God. This superhero sight, because Jesus also has. Jesus, we've seen again and again, very like Elisha. So right at the beginning of John's Gospel, Jesus sees someone from a distance under a fig tree, even though he's not there, and he hasn't got binoculars. He just knows they're there. He just knows everything about everyone. Whereas we don't. And there's a bit of a comedy element of this story, because Elisha knows exactly where the king of Syria is, but then the king of Syria has to find out where Elisha is. Go and see, he says. Go and see where he is so that I may send and seize him. Verse 13. He hasn't really thought this through, has he? He's got quite a lot of confidence in himself, this king of Syria, even though he doesn't have superhero sight. You know, it's like if you're a fan of Blackadder, and all the lines of that is the worst plan since, lines in Blackadder. Some of you don't know what I'm talking about, others of you love it, but it's the worst plan since the king of the Vikings ordered 3,000 battle helmets with the horns on the inside. That's my favourite one. This isn't a very good plan, is it? I found out there's a superhero who can see everything. I know, I'll surprise ambush him. Haven't really thought that through, has he? Because the king of Syria is very confident in his own abilities, even though he's not a superhero. Even though he's not God, he still thinks he can take God on, which is quite foolish. God sees everything, and we don't. Blindness and sight. And then secondly, God can open eyes and blind eyes to what is really going on. So firstly, somehow they do find Elisha. I guess he's not trying to be hidden, and he lets them come. And they find he's in Dathan. They surround him in Dathan. And then you can imagine it's quite a terrifying sight. In the morning, you open the curtains and you look out, and you see the enemy everywhere around you. I think we can imagine this mainly because Hollywood has tried to do this kind of scene. So imagine, you know, Battle of Helm's Deep, if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, or some equivalent. Suddenly everywhere, soldiers and armies. And Elisha's very, very unfussed by this. He's not stressed out about it at all. And he prays to the Lord, "Lord, open his eyes, this young man, my servant, open his eyes that he might see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and behold, the mountain was full of horses of chariots of fire all the way around Elisha. And suddenly the battle looks very, very different. So imagine here's Elisha in the middle, and there in the back row, if you can raise your hand angrily, yeah, there they are, Johanna's got her hand up, yeah. You are the marauding armies of Syria, which look semi-frightening. But then everyone else in this auditorium, I won't get you to shake your hand, your fists. You are the horses and chariots of fire who are working. Don't worry, that's just the curiously loud radiator, which we had problems with last week as well. I think it shuts up after a while. I'm going to continue. So on the back row, you have the Syrian army. But then all the way around Elisha, you have fiery armies. And it's pretty obvious who's going to win. We're safe. But it didn't look that way, because actually people didn't have superhero sight. The Syrians couldn't see. Even the man of God's servant couldn't see. How arrogant it would be to assume that we saw everything. The modern atheist is quite sure of themselves, aren't they? Just like the king of Syria is quite sure of his firepower against a superhero prophet. The atheist says, if I can't measure it with my equipment, it does not exist. You're very confident, aren't you, in your equipment? But you're really sure that it can detect everything? I haven't got a reading on my microscope, so it can't be there. Interesting. Interestingly overconfident. You mean that you don't think there is a spiritual world just because you can't see a spiritual world? Interesting. Open his eyes to see what's really going on. And then secondly, blinding their eyes so that they can see even less what's going on. I mean, the Syrians can't see that much to start with. They can't see any of the fiery army. But then they get really confused. Verse 18, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness. And Elisha then ends up leading them on a wild goose. He says, no, it's not this way. No, it's not this way. Come with me. It's over here. Come over this way. And he sort of leads them. And I guess they can kind of see blurry outlines, but they certainly can't see where they are or which city they're in. And Elisha leads them right into the middle of the land of Samaria. Into the middle of the barracks, so that all of the Israelite troops are now surrounding them. So it's a reversal, right? So in the first scene, they have surrounded Elisha, so they think. They're actually this intervening layer of angels that are invisible to them. But now they're in the Samaritan troops and everything is reversed, and they are surrounded by Israel. And their eyes are opened and they realize, gosh, we're in enormous trouble. Blindness and sight. God sees, God's superhero Elisha, who's the prefiguration of Jesus, he sees more than we see. Just because no other human being see what we're up to does not mean that God doesn't see what we're up to. Just because I can't measure it on my scientific instruments does not mean it does not exist. God sees much further in this world than we do. And he also sees a spiritual world that is invisible to us. And how arrogant it would be, how foolish it would be to have the confidence of the king of Syria, who assumes that the things I don't see, out of sight, out of mind. It's like the child who sees something frightening and then just closes his or her eyes. It's not going to make the monster disappear. It just means you're actually even more vulnerable. It is a foolish thing to do. Strand one, blindness and sight. Now, I was really struggling with this sermon, and Jess was very kind in printing it quite late for me because I just couldn't send it off the outline to her, and it ended up going this morning. So, Jess, I can't see where you are, but thank you very much for your patience. I was basically stressing because I could not decide whether this chapter was about blindness and sight or whether it is about judgment and salvation. I've showed you why I think it's about blindness and sight, but in a minute I'm going to show you what it's about, judgment and salvation. And on Friday, my friend John, he's sitting over there, said, just do both, which is really good advice. And I thought, oh, no, I can't do both. I've got to decide which it is. And I agonized over it on Saturday, and I agonized over it this morning, and Jess sent a little message saying, will the sermon outline be here kind of soonish? And I thought, okay, I'm going to do both. So here we are. This is both. I think it is both. That was the blindness and sight strand. Here is the judgment and salvation strand. And this time we're going to start at chapter 6, verse 1. The sons of the prophet said to Elisha, the place where you dwell is too small for us. Let's go to the Jordan, get a log. Let's make a place to dwell there. One of them said, be pleased to go with your servants. He said, I'll go. So basically this is a DIY project to build an extension on their little church, the place where they meet with Elisha and he teaches them about God. So it's a church extension. Everyone goes to B&Q. They hire some tools. Not B&Q, but the place you can hire it from. You can see how much DIY I do. But anyway, they hire some tools from a tool hire place. And then verse 5, as one's filling a log, his axe fell into the water and cried out, alas, my master, it was borrowed. Where did it fall? He showed him the place. He cut off a stick, threw it in there, and made the iron float. What are we supposed to do with this very strange story in the Bible? Some people have tried to cope with it by explaining the miracle away. So maybe Elisha just has really, really good aim. And he can see the iron bit just nestling below the water, stuck on an underground branch or something. And he gets a bit of wood and throws it in like a spear and just aims a little hole in the axe and manages, you know, by practice. Maybe he does it a few times and it just happens to go in and then the whole thing floats and he gets lucky. I don't think that's what's going on. This is clearly a miraculous thing. Other people try to allegorize it. So say, this isn't really a story about an axe head that floats. It must be a story about something else. Maybe it's a story about, this is one commentary, see if you can guess where it's going with this. The axe head is saved from being lost at the bottom of the water. It's saved by a handle that is made of wood. And that makes us think of something else that saves us that's made of wood. Namely, the cross. Yeah, okay. So, okay, well done. And then the axe head disappears into the water. And then it comes out of the water again. And that makes us think of baptism. Okay, yeah. And the whole thing just becomes an allegory where everything here stands for something else. And there's a really great commentary that I recommend. In fact, all the books by Dale Ralph Davis, I think, are fabulous. He's written a commentary on 2 Kings. He gets pretty annoyed with people doing this allegory. And he says, can you just imagine going shopping on behalf of your partner and then allegorizing your shopping list? And then he gives these examples where instead of doing the thing that you're actually is on the list, you get something that it might stand for in some metaphorical world. And he ends up with you going home with a whole series of different items, which would quite irritate whoever's doing the cooking. Now, the bit of wood is just an axe handle, and it's not baptized, it just floats. I mean, we're just reading too much into it. Nonetheless, this is a miracle that would really help somebody out in a tight spot. Iron was very rare in those days. You've got a lot of bronze around. Iron is quite a valuable commodity. And losing an iron axe head would be very, very expensive, and you wouldn't be able to pay, and it would put you in debt, and you're in a real fix. And God is kind enough to this guy. God cares for the little people, I was going to put as the heading. God cares for the little people and the little things. And he gets him his axe head back, and he's out of debt, and everything's okay. Such a trivial thing in the Bible. Such a huge thing in this bloke's life, and yet God cares. And yet it is quite surprising that he should do this through Elisha, because as we keep saying almost every week of this series, that isn't what we're expecting Elisha to do. Elisha was announced in his job description as being the assassin. I think I've read this almost every week of the series, but here is 1 Kings verse 19, chapter 19, verse 17. Elijah is told, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael saw Jehu put to death. The one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Elisha is the assassin. He's going to clean up. He's going to kill everyone. We're expecting him to bring God's judgment against an evil nation and an evil dynasty. And he doesn't. Everything we've seen of Elisha, one exception where he executes some boys who are mocking God. But with one exception, everything he does has been to rescue people, to save people. And here he saves all kinds of people. Firstly, he saves the remnant, the faithful remnant. Even though the country as a whole in the time of Elisha had turned their back on God and they were worshipping golden calves in fake temples in Bethel and Dan instead of the true God in Jerusalem. Even though the country as a whole had gone off to worship Baal and Ashtoreth and other fake idols, there was a remnant, a small group of people who still trusted in God. And God said that to Elijah. He said, Elijah's coming as the assassin, yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. And we meet this little group, and they're called the sons of the prophets. We've seen them over the weeks. They're the people that cling close to the superhero. They don't go to the official church, because that's corrupt. They don't observe the official national festivals, because they're full of idolatry. But they seek out the man of God who's going to tell them the truth about God in the midst of a culture that turns its back on it. The remnant. And this man with the axe head is one of the sons of the prophets, and God cares about him. God protects his people. Makes me think of a small Christian minority meeting in secret in some countries in the world today. Maybe in North Korea they exist. Maybe one or two Christians getting together and they recognize each other and dare to speak of their shared faith. Are they very, very dangerous? You think of in the Middle East, in Iran, enormous numbers of Iranians becoming Christians in the West, but still very dangerous back home to have a Bible or to confess your interest in Jesus. So I imagine there are some Christians and they meet secretly and God cares for them in the midst of nations that have turned their back on him. God protects the sons of the prophets. Maybe we kind of expect that. But then, even more surprisingly, not only does the assassin save God's remnant, the faithful, the assassin also saves the whole country, and the whole country is anything but faithful. He even saves the king of Israel, and the king of Israel is a complete rogue. So all this intelligence that he keeps leaking to him about where the king of Syria is about to make his next ambush, he spares the evil king of Israel and the whole nation of Israel. And we saw before in the series, this isn't because God's forgotten about judgment, but because God mercifully delays judgment, even for the guilty. The faithful he protects. The guilty he gives a chance. He gives longer. And he extends the deadline to repent. But then even more wonderfully, and I think this is really the surprise climax of this section, God saves the faithful. God saves the nation, even though they've gone astray. But God even saves the enemy. It's not how you're expecting the story to end, is it? That the Syrian enemy gets blinded, led into its own ambush in the middle of Samaria. Their eyes are open, they're in the middle of the barracks. And you can even hear the eagerness, can't you, with the repetition. Verse 21, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down? Shall I? Shall I? I'm ready to massacre them all now. Shall I get them, the enemy?" And Elisha says, "No. No, spare them. In fact, don't just spare them, but throw a banquet for them. Celebrate with them. Show them extraordinary, unexpected mercy." Now, don't get me wrong. This is not a message of mercy instead of judgment. There is going to be judgment. If we keep reading, and we're stopping, as I said, for Easter and then for a bit of Philippians. But when we eventually come back to 2 Kings chapters 8 to 10, there's a lot of judgment. God hasn't forgotten about judgment. But before he comes in judgment, he is willing to show mercy on all kinds of people. The faithful, he cares about the little people who are faithful to him in the midst of a nation that has turned their back on him. But he's merciful to the whole nation. Makes me think of the UK. I mean, we are not biblical Israel, but we are a nation that once had some kind of fear of God nationally and where there was more knowledge of God. But many, many people have turned their backs on him now, and many in our denomination, the Church of England, have turned their backs on the God of the Bible now. But God is merciful. He extends the deadline. He hasn't yet struck us all down. We're still here. I mean, you might look at the current British politics and think that God's patience is running out. But we're still here. No thunderbolts from heaven yet. And then even God's out and out enemies, those who persecute the church of God, don't massacre them. Invite them for a banquet. We're expecting judgment and we get salvation. Now you see my dilemma. I mean, how do I choose, right? This is a sermon about blindness and sight. It's a sermon about judgment and salvation. And John said, do both, which is what I've done. But can we pull them together somehow? This is my attempt, and I'm a bit more tentative about that, about this at the end. Can we pull them together? Judgment and salvation, blindness and sight. Maybe they pair off. God blinds in judgment. You still get a hint of that here. You get a much bigger hint of it in our midweek grace groups. If you're new to church, by the way, we meet on Wednesdays, every Wednesday downstairs here, apart from this week because we stopped for Easter. But normally meet on Wednesdays, and some of us are studying Mark's Gospel, and some of us are studying Isaiah, and I was delighted to discover that the same idea comes up in both books. In Isaiah chapter 6, in Mark chapter 4, God blinds his enemies so that they cannot see. And if you are here today resisting God, or at war with God, or hoping to beat God, can I just suggest to you that you do not have a chance against him with your eyes closed? You can't win a fight with a blindfold on. We cannot win against God. We've seen it in this passage a couple of times, just the hint of the stupidity of having the blindfold on but thinking that you have 20/20 vision. That would be stupid, wouldn't it? The foolishness of the atheist. I can't see God, so he doesn't exist. I can't see the angels, so they're not there. At the same time as there is an army of fire ready to strike down God's enemies. Don't make that mistake. You can't win against the God who can close your eyes to what is true. Give up the fight. But then wonderfully in Isaiah, and this is a slight spoiler because we're going to look at it the first week back over Easter, in Isaiah chapter 35. But in Isaiah 35 and in Mark chapter 8, God also opens eyes. And he opens eyes in mercy, as we've already looked at in our children's talk. He opens our eyes to see things that we couldn't see. The way things really are, spiritual realities that are beyond us. And he does it in mercy. Actually, both openings of the eyes are merciful in this chapter. One of them is to see that God's got a lot of armies on your side. That's the servant of the man of God. See, that's comforting to see how God's fighting for you. That's comforting. The other one is to see there's a lot of soldiers who are not on your side because you're in the middle of the Sumerian camp and about to be killed. But that's merciful as well, because you need to know the situation you're in and call upon mercy, and then you get a banquet instead of an execution. It's always better to see clearly. There might be uncomfortable things that God opens our eyes to, as Steve introduced the confession that way. Maybe we don't want to have our eyes open to our sin, to our rebellion, to God's anger at us. But it's always a good thing. It's always a merciful thing in the Bible to have your eyes opened. Because the God who opens eyes loves to save people, all sorts of people. The little people who are faithful to him, he loves to save them. The nation that rejects him, he loves to at least extend the deadline for them to turn to him. And even the enemy who is surrounded and the game's up and they're expecting to die, and instead God loves to give them a banquet. Don't fight against a God who can blind you, but do pray to a God who can open your eyes. And let's pray that for ourselves, and let's pray that for other people. The lovely thing in this chapter is Elisha prays it on behalf of other people. Lord, please open his eyes so he can see. Lord, please open their eyes so that they may see. We live in a world where many people have their eyes closed and they think they have 20/20 vision. Let's pray that God would mercifully open their eyes to rescue them. I'm going to leave a pause and then we're going to be led in prayer.